This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is off this week. Coming up, Mumia Abu-Jamal says the corporate media are as clueless as ever about why the United States is involved in endless wars. A new book explores anti-black violence in America, and a 25-year study of low-income young people in Baltimore shows that higher education is almost irrelevant to their life chances. But first, Dr. Gerald Horn, one of the most prolific authors and incisive thinkers of our time, has a new book titled The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. Dr. Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. He maintains that the American white settlers broke with their mother country, Great Britain, largely to preserve the system of slavery. American school children are taught that the U.S. War of Independence was about a lot of things, but not that it was a war for slavery.
This brings to mind the old saying that history is bunk, or history is lies agreed upon. The fact of the matter is that slavery was at the heart of the rebels' revolt against London in 1776. Indeed, as I argue in the book, you may recall that Ian Smith, who led the struggle for so-called Southern Rhodesian independence in November 1965, was seeking to forestall decolonization from London. And he argued strenuously that he was walking in the footsteps of 1776, and he had a point to the extent that 1776, in many ways, was an attempt to forestall abolition of slavery by London. You may recall that in June 1772, that a court in London seemed to suggest that abolition certainly would be coming to England. And the inference was quickly drawn across the Atlantic that if it could come to England, it could come to England's colonies as well. And that was a spark that lit the fuse that detonated in revolt, leading to the formation of the nation now known as the United States of America.
You're an historian. You look at old papers. That kind of threat to the prevailing colonial order should have sparked lots of irate editorials and comment in the white settler press.
You are correct. And I quote them at length, in fact. Not only the mainland settler press, but keep in mind that in the 18th century, we're talking about a British Empire that also includes Jamaica, Antigua, Barbados in particular, not to mention other parts of the Americas. And it's fair to say that the slaveholders in these regions were united. Indeed, as I note in the book, as late as the middle of the 18th century, London felt that its Caribbean colonies were more valuable than the mainland colonies. But what helped to change that was the fact that in the Caribbean colonies, the settlers were outnumbered, sometimes at ratios of 20 to 1, and this facilitated massive slave revolts, which helped to chase many of the settlers to the mainland, which helped to change the value of the mainland vis-a-vis the Caribbean as far as London was concerned. Indeed, I think it's fair to say that if you want to look at founding fathers, so-called, of these United States of America, you probably should include the Africans of Jamaica, because it's not only that their rebelliousness helped to convince London that abolition of slavery, rather than a helter-skelter retreat from slavery, was the way to go. But also, after July 4th, 1776, the Africans in Jamaica were in an uproar, helping to divert the Royal Navy to the Caribbean allowing the settlers, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, et al., to gather their wits and to gather their arms and prepare to fight a long war against London.
We've been taught that the Haitian revolt, culminating in 1804, that revolt of black slaves was what put American slaveholders in an hysteria. But you're saying that the American colonists were already at wit's end with fear about previous revolts in English-speaking Caribbean.
That is correct. The Haitian Revolution, which will be the subject of a book I plan to write beginning this year, certainly helped to instill fear into the slave-owning class on the North American mainland. But you have to see the Haitian Revolt as something of a crescendo, not necessarily an initiation. I think it's fair to say that if you go back to 1655, when the British seized Jamaica from the Spanish, not least because the African, quote, Maroons, unquote, had revolted against Madrid and helped to facilitate London's takeover, you could begin to see that the settlers and the slave-owning class and the European powers recognized that Africans were a force to be reckoned with. Indeed, one of the major problems with the way history is taught in our schools today in the United States of America is that it's easy to walk away with the idea that either the Africans were chumps, that is to say, they fought alongside their slave owners, and then the slave owners won, and then the slave owners tightened the handcuffs around their wrists, or the Africans were dumb, that is to say, they did not recognize that London was moving towards abolition, and the settlers were moving in the opposite direction, and so it was in their interest to oppose the settlers, or that the Africans were a cipher. That is to say that they were hardly around in 1776. And it's little wonder that many of our youth get turned off to history, because obviously the determination has been made that it's better to teach a fairy tale than to teach reality and the truth.
Great Britain's big response to the rebellion, mostly in New England, was the governor of Virginia's decision to free all slaves who would join the British forces and help in putting down the rebellion. This, I suppose, was the nightmare moment for the white settlers.
It was a nightmare moment. You're referring to Lord Dunmore in colonial Virginia. But keep in mind that in neighboring North Carolina, Governor Martin was also accused of moving in a similar direction. And given the fact that he had previously resided in Antigua, the very name of which sent a chill of fear down the spines of slaveholders, because it was in 1709 and 1736 that the Africans in Antigua initiated massive planned slave revolts that were determined to liquidate the slaveholding class. But it's not only that, but Britain had reason to move towards abolition of slavery and arming Africans, not least because they were facing competitive pressure from Spain to do the same. Spain had begun to arm Africans as early as the 1500s. The British had lost a decisive battle at Cartagena in what is now Colombia, circa 1740, not least because Spain had armed Africans to defeat the Redcoats, and the European settlers who had been conscripted were rather slow to get to the battle, not least because they were enmeshed in the nasty business of expropriating the indigenous on the North American mainland. And in any case, there was the perception that the heat of the northern coast of South America, not to mention the Caribbean, that Africans were better equipped to deal with such an environment. That was the perception, not necessarily the reality. And so, therefore, the British were under competitive pressure to follow in the footsteps of Spain. The problem was that the settlers had embarked on a model of development that did not presuppose the arming of Africans. It presupposed the enslavement of every African in sight. And this helped to deepen a schism between the settlers and London, which then detonated in an anti colonial revolt, so-called, in 1776. I should also add that I think that the United States in its history is better understood in the context of examining slave regimes in, say, South Africa, for example, or settler regimes, such as in Algeria and Kenya and the Rhodesias and South Africa and Namibia. Too often, you see professors and teachers, they compare the United States to Britain. And certainly, Britain has a lot to apologize for, not least since the head of state is a position that's genetically transmitted. That is to say, you have to be born into a certain family in order to become king or queen. But that gives too much credit to the United States of America, and it basically eludes the fact that should be well recognized that the so-called democracy of the United States was a racialized democracy in the first instance. It was the proclamation of what I refer to as the first apartheid state. And therefore, it's little wonder that as late as 2014, it's difficult to extend the so-called liberties of this so-called republic to the darkest of us all, because the republic was instigated on the premise that the so-called liberties would not be extended to the darkest of us all. In fact, what I argue in the book is that the way to understand what has been referred to as bourgeois democracy in the United States is that the United States had a problem in trying to basically lure Europeans to what was a war zone where Native Americans were on the warpath and Africans were relentlessly plotting. And so therefore, there had to be certain emoluments, enticements, inducements, which included certain rights that Europeans did not necessarily have on the shores of Europe. But to suggest that this then provided a template for the extension of liberties to those who were not defined as, quote, white, unquote, is basically like saying that Nelson Mandela should thank his jailers for his liberation. It's basically a non sequitur and clearly illogical and irrational.
Your book's contention that the white settlers revolted in anticipation that the mother country, Britain, might move towards emancipation is, of course, proven by history in a certain large sense by the fact that the British did free the slaves in their Caribbean colonies in the 1830s.
Not only that, but it's very curious that the so-called Revolutionary Republic, the United States of America, actually replaced Britain as the captain of the African slave trade. As I show in my recently published book on Cuba, one of the reasons you have so many Africans in Cuba is because of the manic energy of U.S. slave traders. As I showed in my book published a few years ago on the African slave trade to Brazil, one of the reasons there are more Africans in Brazil than in any other site outside of Nigeria is because of the manic energy of U.S. slave traders and slave dealers. It's very curious that the Revolutionary Republic becomes the leading slave trader, whereas the alleged colonial ogre, that is London, becomes the cop on the beat trying to stop the so-called Revolutionary Republic from manacling and handcuffing so many Africans and dragging them across the Atlantic. It's also curious that in 2007, the British marked the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the international African slave trade. The United States sought to do the same in 1808, but there was no celebration or ceremony marking that in the United States in 2008, whereas in London, Tony Blair, then Prime Minister, and Queen Elizabeth both spoke at a major ceremony. It's very curious that the Revolutionary Republic does not see fit to mark the abolition of the international slave trade. Not only that, but we have a control group. That is to say, Canada did not revolt against British rule. Therefore, it's supposedly not this grand revolutionary republic like the alleged revolution that took place in the United States of America. And yet, Canada has the single-payer health care system, which is the emblem of a state that seeks to attend to the basic needs of its public. Canada has a third party, a social democratic party, far to the left of the Democratic Party, which passes for a left-wing party in the United States of America. There are so many anomalies to consider when considering the tortured history of the United States of America I think that our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren, assuming that climate change and world war does not overcome us all, will be shaking their heads and wondering, what were we thinking about when we were talking of the United States as an alleged revolutionary republic?
In that same vein, you talk about the manic energies of the American slave trader, those energies then transferred into the filibusterers who sought to implant more slave republics to the south of the United States. And then we have the U.S. policy of bringing most of the Western Hemisphere under its domination.
Well, I talk about that latter point in my recently published book, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, the many efforts by U.S. filibusters to seize Cuba well before, decades before, the Bay of Pigs invasion of 1961. I allude to the filibustering escapades of one William Walker, who in the 1850s actually took over Nicaragua and sought to reinstate the African slave trade. In my book on Haiti, which I noted I'll begin to write rather shortly, I talk about the attempt in the early 1870s by the United States to annex the entire island of Hispaniola, starting with the Dominican Republic, and then moving towards Haiti, and then deporting the U.S. Negro population there. Interestingly enough, this only failed in the Senate by one vote, in fact, the annexation of the DR. So, once again, there are a number of anomalies to consider when one posits the alleged revolutionary nature of this country now known as the United States of America.
And these white settlers who early on thought of themselves as being a proto-empire on the way towards an empire saw that future as an empire of slavery.
Yes, and let's take for a moment the term white, for example. One of the points that I make in the 1776 book is that if there was any genius to the settler class that started the United States of America, it was that they expanded the base of the colonial project by moving away from the religious Cold War, Protestant London versus Catholic Spain and France, and moving towards race, that is to say, those defined as white and those not defined as white. Moving towards race expanded the base of the colonial project, managing to include any with roots from the Atlantic to the Urals and even to the Arab world, since you consider that Ralph Nader, whose roots are in Lebanon, and Marlo Thomas, whose roots are in Lebanon, are both considered, quote, white, unquote. This at once expanded the base of the colonial project and also happened, I'm afraid, to delude all too many with the idea that if rights could be extended to those defined as white, it would be a simple hop, skip, and a jump to extend those rights to those not admitted into the hallowed halls of whiteness. But history tells us that that was a misguided notion at best.
And this would explain the secularism of white slaveholders like Thomas Jefferson and others who basically put down the religious sword and took up the racial solidarity banner in defense of slavery.
Precisely. But keep in mind that, as I note in the 1776 book, the settler class on the North American mainland in many ways only called a formal truce with regard to the religious wars. That is to say, we know that well into the 19th century in the United States, there was fervent anti-Roman Catholic bigotry, fervent anti-Semitism. In other words, this was a formal truce, not necessarily an actual reality. That is to say, the retreat from the religious war.
Well, when did the truce in terms of the racial war begin, or has it?
Well, that's a good question. Has it? But as I point out in the 1776 book and subsequent books that I have written, the fact of the matter is that the African population of the North American mainland, one of the reasons that it has been treated so atrociously, it's not only because of racism, that's a necessary but not necessarily sufficient explanation. It's also because the Africans fought against the proclamation of a slaveholders' republic, then fought against a Jim Crow regime, an apartheid regime, And when one fights a war and loses, or fights a war with an indecisive conclusion, which is fair to say what happened with the fight against the apartheid regime or the Jim Crow regime, the victors tend to treat the losers rather atrociously forevermore if they can get away with it. And one of the ways we've been able to restrain our oppressors is lengthening the battlefield. That is to say, making alliances in the international community, just as we allied with Spain against London, and then we allied with London against the so-called white settlers. Then we allied with Mexico at the time of the Mexican Revolution against the so-called white settler regime. And then there was an alliance by some with Moscow during the Soviet period, and alliance with African liberation movements in the 1950s and the 1960s, when finally the rulers of the United States of America decided that the better part of wisdom was to make an agonizing retreat from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow. The problem faced in 2014 is that now the rulers of the United States feel that the so-called U.S. Negro population or the African-American population either is incapable of forging international alliances, that the black population doesn't understand value, and so therefore they can roll back the Voting Rights Act of 1965 or have a presidential candidate, so-called like Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, talk seriously about repealing the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And you can have all these studies that show that, you know, black pedestrians are more likely to be run down by motorists, and black preschoolers are suspended at a rate much more spectacular than any other group of preschoolers, and all these other egregious violations of human rights, like disproportionately subjected to the death penalty, disproportionately imprisoned. And the rulers feel that we don't understand history and that we've basically been stripped of knowledge and are therefore ripe for the plucking. I'm afraid to say they've made a strategic blunder, that is to say the rulers of the United States, with that kind of analysis, but apparently they don't agree with me.
Dr. Gerald Horn of the University of Houston on his book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. Also coming out this summer, a new book titled Killing Trayvons, an anthology of American violence. South Carolina activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray is one of the editors of this ambitious collection of writings from a wide range of contributors, including Dr. Cornell West, Robin D.J. Kelly, Bell Hooks, V.J. Prashad, and many more. The book's focal point is, of course, the killing of Trayvon Martin. But Kevin Alexander Gray says anti-black violence in America is a huge subject.
You do have to organize it from the perspective that America is a violent place, and Trayvon Martin's murder was an anomaly. It was something that happens all the time, all day, every day. And in fact, every, 28 hours, someone black is killed by police or killed by someone under the color of law. And it goes back further than Emmett Till. It goes back to the idea of enslavement. So it was a big topic to cover. The fact that we call it Killing Trayvon is because of the plural nature of the violence that affects people of color. And we wanted to cover not just the trial. We do cover that, but we want to cover issues around the trial, the epidemic of killings by the police, the fact that it's not just young black men that are killed, there are black women that are killed, like Renisha McBride, like Anaya Jones in Detroit. The list goes on and on and on. It's a big subject. We tried to take the trial and look at the trial and what it was trying to say. We included the closing remarks by O'Mara because we thought that his closing was important. We included the testimony of Sabrina Fulton because that was important. We even put in the comments of President Obama after the shooting and after the verdict. So we kind of put some of the articles that and some of the essays that people have written on the Trayvon Martin murder and put it around the trial documents, to put it around the public documents, the autopsy reports, some of the reports that even George Zimmerman had called in to the police department. We even went as far as having some people who maybe even agree with the jury verdict because they thought the prosecution put on such a weak case. We have poetry in there. A young fellow I met while I was in California, David Judah One, does some poetry. Alexis Gums does some poetry. Rita Dove does poetry for the book. So we've covered the waterfront. Of course, we got a couple of pieces on Oscar Grant, Amadou Diallo's fathers has a piece in the book. You have a piece in the book. Margaret Kimberly has a piece in the book. We thought that we pulled out some of the best articles, essays, and prose on the whole idea of systemic violence on people of color to take the Trayvon Martin murder as a benchmark in violence against people of color in America and go back and talk about his historic dimensions. We even got some interesting kinds of pieces like, what if Trayvon Martin were Asian? What if he were an Arab American? What if he were a woman? What if he were white? And so I think that the book is a complete anthology of all the aspects and issues around the idea of the murder of people of color with impunity by the structure, not just police, but by this whole structure of racism and white supremacy that we live under.
And you've got a whole kaleidoscope of writers from Cornel West to Jesse Jackson, Vijay Prashad. How eager were the writers to participate in this venture?
You know, everybody that we contacted, with the exception of a very few, were eager to participate because we think that when people go back and look at all the issues around the Martin case and at a particular time in history, in the history of this country, that they will refer to this book because it will have the information in it for them. And so most of the people were willing to participate. Nobody asked us, did we have any money to pay them, because they knew we didn't. There are a couple of people that did. There were only a couple of people that kind of gave us the stiff arm. We were only asking them to contribute pieces that they had already written. I had one person tell me, well, I'm too busy. So you're too busy to hit a send button. And I had one person we asked to participate who spoke of themselves in the third person. They didn't do that. But other than that, everybody else was really, really positive about the book, willing to help. You know, when you've got writers who have a name, it's sometimes hard to get to them, but we went through those barriers and jumped through those hoops to try to get the ones that we really, really wanted. There are a couple of pieces that I wish we could have gotten. I wish we could have gotten Questlove's Trayvon Martin Ain't Shit and Neither Am I, but it was because he is so popular and it's just hard to get to him, so we had to leave that one out. And even as it relates to the Cornel West piece, we didn't ask Cornell to write a piece because that interview that he did with Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman covered a lot of ground. It covered this idea of Obama using drones and linking that to Zimmerman as a drone. And so that served that purpose. We had an interview with bell hooks. In those cases, them talking about the subject was better for us than them writing about it. It just seemed more free-flowing, and it went with the tenor and tone of the book, and it kept the book at a certain pace.
Certainly, this book ought to have shelf life just by the nature of the subject matter. Historically, virtually every black civil disturbance or rebellion has been sparked by police or quasi-government violence against black folks.
That is true, and Candace Seasway, Tim Arenga, wrote a piece about black folk rioting, and I think is an interesting piece. But, you know, we're not as organized as we once were, and maybe I'm being nostalgic. We've gotten so used to the language of police violence tied to the drug war, tied to thug life, that when the police throw a flash grenade through somebody's window and kill a child, or when the SWAT kicks in the door to execute a drug warrant or a drug search, anytime you hear the words drug-related, we tend to kind of dismiss it. And then when you're talking about black males in particular and this idea that, and the president does it on a regular, that they're really worthless, they're not men but boys, then that's a whole different dilemma. And then you've got people comparing young black males and the violence that, because of institutional factors, the violence that they might commit on one another. You got people comparing that to the Ku Klux Klan. So our perspective of black violence, even this idea of black on black violence, like there's no such thing as white on white violence, these kinds of things have shaped how we view black life and how tough it is institutionally, how tough it is as relates to the police, how tough it is as relates to the criminal justice system. We, a lot of people, because I'm going to stop saying we, because I'm certainly not one of them, a lot of people seem to think that black folk get what they deserve, and they're not looking at, as I said, the historic factors that have gotten us to where we are today.
You seem to be saying that for lots of folks, they seem to be inured to the violence against black people, but there was a tremendous reaction to the Trayvon Martin killing.
Yeah, there was before and during the trial, but the issue beyond his murder was also stand your ground. And as an organizer, I think that you have to find the issue that keeps people moving and focus on change. Now, if you can go out there and find a movement that is combated, stand your ground, that's combating the proliferation of gun rights from concealed carry, now they're moving to open carry. If you can find that movement, let me know and I'll join it. But that's not what we saw. We haven't seen a coordinated effort in the state legislatures to take on stand your ground. And we're kind of conflicted on stand your ground. We've got a piece in there about Marissa Alexander. And if you're opposed to stand your ground, but you're demanding that Marissa Alexander be afforded kind of the same protection by the justice system that George Zimmerman got, well, basically you're arguing for equal injustice as opposed to arguing against stand your ground. Now, that's not to say that the court system didn't do her wrong, and maybe it was self-defense. I don't know. I mean, when looking at the case, and the fact that there was a child in the room with the person that she apparently was shooting at, then that raises a whole lot of issues beyond just claiming that her right to stand your ground was violated. So where are our think tanks? Where are our organizers? Where are the people in the community that say these are the laws that we have to tackle to have some sort of institutional impact on how white supremacy or racism distorts our lives? I haven't seen that. There are a lot of people on TV, and no question, it was a travesty, that young man's death. It's a travesty that racial profiling exists. But what do we do about it institutionally? We can't just say to young men, when the police come, show them your hands and comply and cooperate and be docile and let the police just have their way and diminish or disregard your rights. It can't just be about that. It can't be just about, young man, pull your pants up or don't wear a hood, or this proliferation of local laws that are fining people for wearing their pants low, which gives the police another reason to profile and stop them. It can't be just that. Institutionally, we should be going after stand your ground, and we should be looking at the proliferation of gun rights laws.
Some of us come from a generation when the cry was self-defense is an inherent right, and I'm talking about black folks.
And I believe in self-defense. But now, what we have now is beyond self-defense. Self-defense means that you believe that your life is in danger. Self-defense doesn't mean that because somebody is playing their music loud and you tell them to turn it down and they don't, you shoot them. Self-defense isn't you walking up to some young man whose pants is pulled down or hanging down below his belt and you say, pull your pants up, and he breaks bad and you pull out your gun and kill him. Self-defense isn't somebody who's walking across your yard and you don't want them on your property, so you claim a threat and you shoot them. Self-defense, we got a stand your ground case here in South Carolina where the young man shot somebody and paralyzed the person. He was shooting at somebody, missed, bullet ricocheted, and paralyzed a young college student, and he's claiming stand your ground. Or the father whose daughter here in South Carolina was being chased by a group of kids. He goes outside with his gun. He sees a group of kids. He shoots in the wrong group of kids, kills somebody, claims stand your ground, and walks. So because the kids he saw just happened to be black. So self-defense shouldn't be a substitute for your duty to retreat if, in fact, your life isn't really in danger. And this whole idea of what is a threat, what is threatening to you, that's the problem. But we learned it. The kids learn it. Society learns it from the master, and that's our government, in which you're killing people that you think are a threat to you without any due process of law. Because that's what Stand Your Ground does. It makes the shooter the judge, jury, and the executioner. That's what this idea where the police decide that they're going to kill one black male every 28 hours. They're the judge, jury, and executioner. Oftentimes for crimes that if they were adjudicated, the person would not get the death penalty, would get nothing near the death penalty. So this is the kind of society that we're in. We're still arguing and putting on the television screens Dick Cheney arguing that we should reinvade Iraq like we should have done it in the first place under the guise that Iraq had something to do with 9/11, or they might be in leagues with Al-Qaeda, or killing Al-Awlaki's son, 16-year-old son. Why? Because he might grow up and be mad because you killed his father without due process? I mean, it flows down, not up. And as long as we live in a society that is predicated on violence, that's predicated on killing enemy before they're even enemy, and constantly making new enemies because they're constantly taking people's stuff, then we're not going to solve the problem of violence in society.
Studies have shown that white households are proportionately twice as likely to possess guns as black households. However, in practice, gun control measures, police gun control tactics, seem to focus only on black America.
Well, look, I believe in the right of self-defense. I don't think that the Second Amendment is just about the right of self-defense as an individual. I think historically the Second Amendment is about the right to revolt against a government that is being tyrannical. And that's the secret of the Second Amendment that no one ever wants to talk about. I might even argue that black folk and white folk own guns in different ways because there are, what, over 300 million guns in the country? I suspect they're way a lot more than that. But no, the gun laws have always been about protecting white folks' right to have guns so that they can keep control of the growing minority groups in, or so-called minority groups in this country, which are black and brown. And white folk always have the right to defend themselves in the context of white supremacy in America. And we also know historically that a lot of the gun control laws came from folk like the Deacons for Defense or the Black Panthers and white fright of black revolution. I just don't know if at this point in time that kind of revolutionary movement is ever going to spring up amongst people of color in this country. Maybe I could be wrong, but I don't see it because we're just not where we were 30 years ago politically and consciously. We desegregated into a burning house wanting to have the accoutrements of capitalism and wealth and blingism, and most of our leaders, every one of them, promote the high life and promote the American dream where you can have the 3 and 4 cars and you can dream to drive the Bentley and you can dream to be a millionaire. That's what people strive for. They're striving to be capitalists, and most of them see themselves as frustrated capitalists, to where it's not about revolution, it isn't about equity, it isn't about egalitarianism. It's about I got mine and you get yours. And that kills the revolutionary spirit.
And where can people get this book, which is chock-a-block with different perspectives on violence in America?
It's published by Counterpunch Books. Me, Joanne Vipiewski, and Jeffrey St. Clair, the editors of the book, is going to come out, and I think in 3 formats, the basic paperback, a print-on-demand, and it's going to be an e-book. So it will be available online, probably through Counterpunch Books. From the interest that I see in it, from just the initial announcements, I think it's going to be a really, really special book. I think that people will be proud to own it and read it and appreciate the people's contributions to it. And I think that they can learn a lot from it. And they won't be disappointed to buy it.
Kevin Alexander Gray, one of the editors of the soon-to-be-released book, Killing Trayvons, an Anthology of American Violence. 25 years ago, a team of researchers at Johns Hopkins University set out to track the lives of 790 low-income black and white children in Baltimore. The study is now complete. The resulting report is titled The Long Shadow. It's co-authored by Johns Hopkins sociologist Dr. Carl Alexander, who's been in touch with the kids from the very beginning. Dr. Alexander's team found that higher education turned out to be not very useful to these young people.
Now, we started with them when they were 6 years old, and we finished up when most of them were 28 years old. So it spans a good bit of time and tracks them all through their educational experiences from first grade into higher education beyond, for those who made it into higher education. But at age 28, when we asked them about their college experience and how far they'd gone through school, only 4% of the young people we classified as disadvantaged at the outset, only 4% had finished a baccalaureate degree. And that compares with 45% of children of more advantaged family background. That's a tenfold difference in baccalaureate degree completion. It's really quite shocking. So a handful of the urban disadvantaged manage to follow through on that good advice, but the vast majority, sadly, don't. And it's often not because they lack interest or for want of trying. Three times the number who finished a baccalaureate degree had started a program, and round numbers, about 15% had started a program. And another 15 to 20% had started a two-year college degree. But the vast majority of those who started down that path of higher education weren't able to see it through to a successful conclusion. And so they're not going to realize the benefits that come with a college degree when they go on to try to establish themselves in the world of work.
So how do you serve the needs of the 96% who won't get a degree by the time they're 28 years old?
Well, we'd like to arrange things so that more of them can achieve success, especially given that most of them want to do well in school and move up that way. I mean, we talk to these youngsters as young adults. 80% of the entire study group said that they intended to continue in school at some point. That's at age 28 when we talked to them. And that includes 85% of permanent high school dropouts. That is, as young adults, they did not have a high school degree or alternative certification through the GED. 85% of those young people nevertheless say that they intend to continue in school. So a lot more of the children who start out life in disadvantaged circumstances, a lot more of them try to go down the college path and succeed. And many of them would like to be able to be successful in that way, including most high school dropouts. When we talked to them along the way at different ages, the vast majority of them regretted that they hadn't been more focused on school at the time and thought that their lives would be better if they had stayed the course. So to return to the question, what can we do to help more of these young people achieve what they want to achieve? And sadly, it's not an easy answer to that because the obstacles they encounter are in place all along the way. At the start of college, what we know from the experiences of our study youngsters, but also from the broader literature, there are several considerations that come into play that throw up interference. Many at the start of college have weak academic skills. They're not as well prepared moving out of high school as is expected of them in the college environment. And many of them are obliged to take corrective actions through remedial courses that often don't carry college credit. So strengthening the skill set coming in would be useful. Clarity of purpose helps if you're focused and engaged. A lot of young people just have a very vague sense of why it is that they should be going to college and what they're doing there. They don't necessarily have a specific program of study that they're focused in on. And that makes it easier for them to drift over time if they lack clarity of purpose. But a large issue, and I actually think the one that looms largest for the Baltimore sample that we've worked with, is that they confront formidable challenges outside of school that complicate things for them. Often they have to step out for a time to take care of family responsibilities. It might be the needs of a child or of a relative, a parent, where they have to step in and help out. They may have to step out to shore up their finances so that they can cobble together the money for another semester's tuition and then restart. They often have complicated lives where scheduling becomes challenging for them. And it also is the case that a good many of them get caught up in the criminal justice system, and that complicates going to school, staying to school, but also finding steady employment. There's a whole host of life's challenges outside of school that spill over to complicate staying the course in college. What we find in this experiences of the youngsters we've been following, but also in the broader literature, is that middle-class children are much more likely to follow what we refer to as the kind of fast track into and through college. They're much more likely to begin college right after high school, to attend full-time without interruption. And many of them are living away from home on residential campuses where they get more involved in the school experience. Poor children, and there are always exceptions, but in the main, poor children tend to follow a kind of a slow meandering path into and through college. They're more likely to have an interruption between high school and college. They're more likely to have to step out from college for a time that interrupt their enrollment. They're more likely to be attending part-time, and they're more likely to be commuting students. And we know from the broader literature that each of those facets of their personal experience make it harder to stay the course and continue in college through graduation. So there are a whole host of really quite daunting challenges that these young people face along the way. The issue of strong academic preparation obviously extends back before the end of high school. And for all sorts of reasons, we would want to kind of strengthen their school experience and their academic preparation as far back as our research extends to the beginning of first grade. Poor children, African American and white, tend to start school already behind academically. Their test scores lag behind on average, and they fall farther behind along the way. So strengthening their school experiences, kindergarten through high school, would be an important part of the agenda. But it's a big, complicated agenda. There's no single consideration that stands out that if you fix this, everything else falls into line.
Baltimore is a 60% black city. You included poor white kids from Baltimore in your study as well, and you found that white poverty isn't stigmatized as black poverty is. How is racially stigmatized poverty different?
This project presented an unusual opportunity to compare the experiences of a group of typical kind of low-income whites against low-income African-Americans, you know, attending a public school system in a high-poverty, deindustrializing city. In most of the literature on the urban poor, you hardly ever see any attention directed to the experiences of the white poor, but they're there. They're there in Baltimore. They're a presence in all of our large cities. But because we started this project with a representative random sample, beginning first graders, we actually caught into our sampling web, we picked up a goodly number of low-income or working-class white children in terms of white background, family background. 40% of those that we classify as urban disadvantaged based on parents' education level, family income, and the parents' employment experience, 40% of them are white. So the white and African-American contrasts along the way, I think, are quite revealing, and it's an uncommon opportunity to compare their experience. What we find, where race most clearly comes into play in the picture that we're able to develop out of our book, is in employment opportunities in the non-college labor market. And specifically, white men of disadvantaged family background have labor market advantages as young adults, and they're quite pronounced advantages. White men have much greater access than their African American counterparts to high skill, high pay employment in the remnants of Baltimore's industrial core, that is, in the construction crafts and the skilled trades. So at age 28, we find that 45% of the white men of disadvantaged background are working in that sector of the economy, which is the highest wage sector of the non-college workforce. 45% of white men are working in the industrial crafts and skilled trades. And that compares to 15% of the African-American men. So that's a huge disparity in what is the most kind of lucrative sector of the non-college labor market. But within that sector, if you compare the 45% to the 15%, the white earnings are twice the African-American earnings, roughly $44,000 to $22,000, which is another huge disparity. And what that tells us is that even within that sector, when African-Americans are able to access it, they're not getting the high-wage, high-skill jobs. They're at the lower end of the spectrum. But this differential, it just doesn't happen when people are approaching age 30. We see it all along the way in their workforce experience. So when we asked them during high school about their employment, either during the summer or after school, during the school year, 20% of white men of disadvantaged background had part-time jobs in the construction trades and the industrial crafts. 20% in high school, not a single African-American was employed in that sector of the economy. And what we see happening here, it's really a family network advantage. If your father was in the trade, you know, electrician or a plumber or a welder, auto mechanic, or your uncle or your neighbor across the street, or the friends down at the corner bar, there's a very vibrant neighborhood bar scene in Baltimore. That can help open opportunities. That can help open doors into the world of work. And the picture that we sketch here shows that white men of disadvantaged background are much more successful in finding employment of that sort through their parents' social networks and social contacts. At age 22, when we asked everyone how they found their current jobs, white men were much more likely to say through family and friends, and African-American men were much more likely to say on their own. So this is a pattern that really emerges quite vividly in the experiences of these two groups of young men. Actually, I don't mean to be neglectful of women, because we talked to them as well about their employment experience. But it's interesting that the women of disadvantaged background, African-American and white, a much higher percentage of them are concentrated in the, I guess what you call the traditional pink-collar sectors of service and clerical work, which is low-wage work. And so women's earnings were lower than white men's, as were African-American men's earnings. So African-American men of modest background who managed to access these skilled trades were really doing much better financially at age 28 than anyone else. And also, it's not just financially, their employment, they're more likely to be employed at any point in time. They're more likely to be working full-time. Their spells of unemployment were shorter. So there's a whole pattern of advantage there that traces back to being able to access what's left of Baltimore's kind of a blue-collar industrial and construction trades.
Regarding black women, clearly racism limits their job opportunities and their housing opportunities and other opportunities, but you say it also limits their marriage prospects.
Yeah, we do see that. We organize it in terms of being either married or in a stable long-term partnership of at least 3 months. And that's becoming so typical that to limit ourselves to kind of marriage as such would be too limiting. But what we do find is that all along the way, African-American women are much less likely than whites of similar background to be married or in a stable partnership. And that has consequences also. The most immediately relevant, I think, is that they are not the beneficiaries of having a second earner in the household. And so women who are on their own are much more likely to suffer what's referred to nowadays as the feminization of poverty, and that's why. Also, many of these women have parenting responsibilities, so the financial challenges they face are magnified even more. But here's an interesting twist. Again, because we were able to compare the experiences of whites and African-Americans of modest background, both groups of women, African-American and white, had a high percentage of teen pregnancies and teen births. That is, a high percentage of both were mothers as teenagers. But the white women were much more often parenting within a family union, either with a spouse or a live-in partner. And the African-American women were much more likely to be parenting alone, which, as I just said, adds to their financial challenges. So these marriage patterns, or partnering patterns, if you will, really do have implications for women's financial well-being. And that's well-known. I mean, that's not peculiar to the experiences here in Baltimore. We've seen much the same nationally in the demography of family life. But again, these are the young people whose lives we've been following, and we see it quite vividly in their experiences.
Dr. Carl Alexander at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. American soldiers are streaming back to Iraq, and so is the U.S. corporate media. But neither the U.S. military nor the American media seem to have learned any lessons from their previous wars. Political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal has this report for Prison Radio.
One would think that after the hellish debacle of Iraq, the primary role of the corporate media, that of chief cheerleader, would have given rise to soul-searching, or at least professional reconsideration and retraining of young journalists. If the news of late is any indication, that ain't happening. Check any news service, and no doubt you'll see or hear questioning of some retired military official about how we should attack something or somebody. There isn't even the pretense of objectivity. Journalists use the royal we to mark their service to the state and the corporations in support of war. If the media projections are taken as reflections of reality, no one opposes U.S. military action. It's assumed we are down with the cause. It doesn't matter where, Syria, Nigeria, Iraq. Every few weeks, a new outrage and a new invitation to unleash the dogs of war. But the bitter truth is Americans are sick to death of war. The country has just recently begun to end its longest war, one that may be remembered as its dumbest war yet. Quite an accomplishment, come to think of it. But the media, long lambasted as the liberal mouthpiece, seems determined to steer the pot. They failed miserably in the run-up to the Iraq War. They are failing today. They are so busy obeying their bosses that they're betraying their viewers, listeners, and readers. They have become heralds of hell. From their disastrous performance in selling the Iraq War, they have learned nothing.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio.
Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.